Welcome to this week's broadcast of the Progressive News Network. I will be your guest host, human citizen Christine Sylvain, reporting from the Sunshine State. Today we'll be discussing Florida House Bill 633, which requires a woman wait 24 hours before receiving an abortion. The bill now sits on Governor Rick Scott's desk, waiting to be vetoed or signed and enacted. If signed, it will go into effect on July 1st of this year. Well, you hear a new law like this, and most people don't bat an eye. They think, well, that sounds good. Why wouldn't someone wait a period of time before making such an important decision? Many people do not realize how this bill undermines women's autonomy and decision-making and unfairly targets poor women. Studies have found that waiting periods and abortion restrictions in actuality do not decrease the amount of abortions. They do not help women's health outcomes. And they're often an undue burden, an economic hardship, and an emotional hardship. So let's just paint the scene of why this seemingly innocuous restriction is such a big blow to women's rights. And to do that, we have to start at the beginning. Lest we forget what it was like prior to the legalization of abortion in 1974, Ms. Magazine co-founder Letty Cotton Pogrebin perfectly summarizes the fear she faced and the danger she faced in her at-home abortion.
Women who got pregnant before Roe v. Wade had very few options. Your doctor wouldn't help you because it was illegal. Your parents wouldn't help you because you probably were too afraid to tell them about it. So we were basically thrown onto each other's doormats and said, help me, what do you know? There were known doctors who would do abortion. There were people who did it on kitchen tables. There were people who did it to themselves with lye and with knitting needles. Women died. Lots of women died. When I found out I was pregnant, I was in my senior year in college. I would have killed myself. This isn't hyperbole. If I couldn't have had an abortion at 18, I would have killed myself because I couldn't see how I could possibly live my life. I had to work. I didn't have, you know, rich parents who were going to support me. I didn't have a husband. I asked my dorm counselor for help, and she said she couldn't help me. And my roommate and I found out about, through the grapevine, a fantastic, saintly doctor, Dr. Spencer, in Pennsylvania. Dr. Spencer is famous for being devoted to safe abortions because his daughter was killed by an abortionist. And he stopped everything and changed his practice. I went there, and he was a very caring and careful person. He had a nurse. I slept over on a little cot. My roommate was with me, and we came back, and all was fine. But the stories that I heard, the friends of mine who went, you know, out of the country, went to Mexico, were treated in alleyways and literally in dirty kitchens. It was so terrifying. And every woman faced that as a kind of price that you would pay for illicit sex.
Women have long been disenfranchised by having numerous children that they had to take care of with little control over their family planning. This resulted in them being removed from the public sphere and stunted women's progress overall. But then along came the pill.
You whined and dined me when I was your girl. Promised if I'd be your wife, you'd show me the world. But all I've seen of this old world is a bed and a doctor bill. I'm tearing down your brooder house, cause now I've got the pill.
So, since 1974, women have received abortions legally, though many have had to face extremely contentious conditions to do so. Speaking with Diane Price-Ferndale from the University of South Florida in the Department of Women's and Gender Studies, and I'd like to ask you to kind of give us a brief history of how abortion has been legislated and become illegal in the United States.
So abortion was legal, or at least it wasn't illegal. There just really weren't any laws against it up until the 1880s. There began to be some purity campaigns that came out in the as early as the 1820s, but they were kind of spotty and very state or local specific. The U.S. didn't legislate against abortion until the 1880s, when one of the postal inspectors named Anthony Comstock became outraged by the fact that people could buy birth control or abort a patient or pornography through the mail. And he's kind of an anti-sex guy. And he drafted a bill, drafted legislation, took it to Washington, D.C., and managed to get it passed. And it declared it illegal to distribute either birth control or abort a patient through the mail. And now, in some ways, this wasn't an entirely bad thing because there was no regulation. And so the things that were available through the mail sometimes were reliable and safe, and sometimes they were not. And so it wasn't a completely bad thing. But it did begin the path of the United States legislating against reproductive rights and health.
Mm-hmm.
Another component of it in the 19th century was the American Medical Association. Back in the 19th century, almost all women who delivered babies did so with midwives. And because they had a relationship with the midwife, because they trusted her, they also often went to midwives for other healthcare needs.
Mm-hmm.
And the AMA didn't like that. The AMA wanted that business for themselves. Now, in some cases, again, this was a kind of a good thing because some midwives were untrained, unskilled, and not particularly safe. But for the most part, neither were doctors in
right.
the 19th century. They didn't really understand much about anatomy. They didn't have any clue about bacteria. And so they were pretty scary as well, but they wanted the business, so they began discrediting midwifery. And part of discrediting midwifery was to depict midwives as people who killed babies and people who performed abortions.
Mm-hmm.
And so part of declaring abortion illegal was about the AMA squeezing out some competition. Now, of course, there were always people who had religious objections,
mm-hmm.
But for the most part, abortion has been a kind of normal part of human life through all of human history up until around the 19th century.
Okay, and how has that beginning of legislating against abortion, how does that tie into the debate today, where it's largely pro-life, religious-backed movement trying to get restrictions put on what has been made legal in Roe v. Wade?
Well, it's interesting because there's some recent research, just came out in the last couple of weeks, that says that Americans are not really quite as divided over the whole abortion question as it might appear if you look at our legislatures. And I think this is a really fruitful sort of place to look. Because if you ask people subtle questions, if you ask them, let me back up. If you ask them general questions, kind of sweeping questions, are you pro-abortion? Are you pro-life? Are you against abortion under any circumstances? Are you for abortion under any circumstances? You do get a fairly polarized set of answers. If you ask a lot more subtle questions and you present people with more specific circumstances or more specific people, you get a much more subtle set of answers. This has also, by the way, been true for a long time, that if you ask people who are not themselves facing an unwanted pregnancy whether they would ever consider abortion, their answers are very different than when you ask people who are actually facing an unwanted pregnancy.
Mm-hmm.
And we've known this for a really long time.
Mm-hmm.
So it's one thing for a very small group of people, and this is actually a very small group of people. There's about 10 to 12% of the American population who would categorize themselves as anti-abortion under any circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
And then even another small group who say, well, okay, I'll make a few exceptions
mm-hmm.
for rape, incest, life of the mother, that sort of thing. But really, somewhere around 70% of Americans have a much more subtle view of it.
So why do you think 27 states have now started putting restrictions on abortion, waiting periods, and counseling requirements and whatnot?
Because of money and because of the way politics works now, people are afraid to offend. By people, I mean legislators. Let me just say, legislators are afraid of the way the money works and the way politics work. There may only be somewhere between 10 and 30% of people who vote on pro-life issues, but there's a lot of money backing it. And one of the big questions is whether the money backing it is genuinely people who have heartfelt conviction or people who see it as a way of manipulating American politics.
Okay. Well, can you elaborate a little bit more on that? That sounds very interesting to me. Like, you know, abortion, the pro-life issue, kind of manipulating the full scope of American politics. Is there more details you can give me there?
Yes, because you can use it as a kind of emotional wedge issue.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you catch me on a paranoid day, and I don't know whether today is a paranoid day. I've been working on some other things today that are kind of simultaneously funny and horrifying. So some days I'm more paranoid than others. But on a paranoid day, I will tell you that controlling women's reproduction is a way of controlling women.
Yes, I see that.
And if what you can manage is to keep women afraid, keep women poor, keep women in positions where they cannot contest bad policy because they're so busy raising children that they can't really afford to raise,
mm-hmm.
or they don't really have the resources to raise,
mm-hmm.
then you can run roughshod over them on other issues.
Right.
That's the cynical.
That's a very interesting point. I think it's true to a degree. But go on.
Yeah, I think it is true to some degree. I don't know that that's a position that I'd be willing to go out and kind of stake my career on.
But it's definitely something to discuss and consider.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And, you know, we have to think about where is that money coming from in American politics and what is their goal? As best I can tell from the right, the people with the money are pretty cynical about how they're using their money. I don't know that I think they're really true believers in these causes. I think they've seen a way that they can use true believers to manipulate the system for their own profit and goals.
Mm-hmm. Do you see this new battle for waiting limits and access to reproductive rights as the new front lines of the women's liberation movement, in a sense?
Oh, it's hard to say. There are so many front lines that it feels to me like
mm-hmm.
I'm fighting right now. But this is definitely one of them. And the part about these waiting limits and the measure that the House passed yesterday in terms of banning so-called late-term abortions,
mm-hmm.
is they're really trying to eat away at women's access, but it's not just all women that they're legislating against. It is specifically poor women.
Right.
Because wealthy women have the resources
right.
to do this. Wealthy women can find a doctor who will take care of them. Wealthy women can afford to go to a clinic 2 days in a row.
Right.
The one that Florida has passed, this 24-hour waiting period, is specifically aimed at poor women. If you think about, okay, so there are not abortion clinics uniformly spread out across Florida. So already there's a geographic discrimination against women who live in rural communities. They have to either have a car, find someone with a car, or somehow or else find transportation to get across the state to a clinic.
Mm-hmm.
Then they have to do it
right.
Twice.
Find child care for maybe other children, take
exactly.
time off work.
They have to find, get off work, they have to find child care. I mean, this is stuff that if you're an upper middle class woman, this is just not a big deal for you.
Right.
But if you're a waitress.
Right. I mean, you look at the women who are now being arrested for leaving their kids in the car while they go in interviews or letting them play in the park while they go fill out applications. It's kind of all the same thing, as you so eloquently put, disenfranchising a group of what could be empowered female voices.
Exactly. So, I mean, there's just a whole slew of these things that you can put in the same category.
Mm-hmm.
We, for instance, are trying to pass laws, or in some places have passed laws, so-called fetal endangerment laws,
mm-hmm.
where it makes it illegal to arrest women who are caught drinking or using drugs while they're pregnant, or
mm-hmm.
doing something else that someone else deems dangerous.
Immoral. Mm-hmm.
But meanwhile, we don't provide any kind of facilities for drug treatment for women who get pregnant. And we don't provide easy access to abortion for women who get pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, imagine yourself, people get addicted to painkillers.
Mm-hmm.
We know this. And sometimes very legitimately, they're not setting out to be drug users, but they get addicted to painkillers. Surprise, surprise, painkillers make it harder for you to keep track of your birth control, so you end up pregnant. So then we won't let you get an abortion. We won't let you have drug treatment. What we're going to do instead is arrest you for it.
Right.
It's nonsensical. And if you look at it from a kind of an evidence-based position, you really have to raise the question of what are we actually trying to legislate here?
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, I thank you so much for your eloquent, you know, kind of arguments and your expertise. Do you have any advice for women to confront, you know, these new movements as a whole?
What I do in the course that I teach is I have this whole thread that runs through the course where I argue that the feminist health movement argued for evidence-based medicine. Back in the 60s when we began the feminist health movement, when our foremothers began the feminist health movement, what they argued is that rather than forcing women just to rely on what the doctor thought was best for them, they wanted evidence from medicine that said this really was best practice.
Mm-hmm.
And what I argue in my class is that what we really need to do now is have evidence-based policy around all women's health issues. And we need to look at, okay, if this is our policy goal, what would be the best way to accomplish it? Not in terms of our emotions about it, but about really trying to accomplish our policy goal. So if you really want to reduce abortions in America, we have decades worth of evidence about how you do that. You provide safe, reliable, and free birth control and medically accurate universal sexual education. It is really not rocket science.
So that's where we need to focus our energy.
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, and all kinds of just, let's look at the evidence that's out there and let's argue policy not on emotional issues, because we're not going to all have the same emotions or the same ideological position, but we can all agree on facts,
mm-hmm.
and agree on evidence about what really works. Trying to legislate abortion doesn't work. The countries in the world where the abortion rate is the highest are the countries in the world where abortion is illegal.
Right. So lots of things to think about there. One thing about this new trend that's really disturbing to me is that waiting period or no waiting period, women's access to abortions is completely unequal through the federally provided Affordable Care Act and Obamacare.
Some states allow for abortion to be covered under the Medicaid expansion, and some do not.
And that, to me, is an undue hardship and unequal access. Lots to think about. I really appreciate your time. It's been very interesting for me.
This is good. Thank you.
If Governor Scott signs this bill into law, Florida will be the 27th state to enact a waiting period before abortion. Florida House Representative Jennifer Sullivan sponsored the bill. She said she did it to protect women from being pushed into abortions, but the reality is that it's part of a larger conservative push across the nation to attack women's reproductive autonomy. Jennifer Sullivan is a 23-year-old homeschooled conservative Christian from Orlando. Coming from the background that she does, she's definitely extremely disconnected from the type of women this bill will affect. With that in mind, next we will speak to Kelly Garcia from the National Women's Law Center, who will give us a good rundown of the legal basis for the restriction. We are speaking with Kelly Garcia, Senior Counsel at the National Women's Law Center. How are you today?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you so much for being with us. We're talking about the new national trend to instill a waiting time before a woman is able to receive an abortion. And I'd just like to know what your thoughts are on this new trend. Florida might be the 27th state to enact it. And it's something that conservative houses are trying to do more and more. And I'd like to just get your comments.
So, yes, there are currently 26 states, as you said, have mandatory delays on women's ability to access abortion. Most states are 24 hours, although we're also seeing not just the new trend in, not just this trend in having the mandatory delays, but also a trend in moving towards increasing delays. So North Carolina, for example, increased their delay recently. It has a bill to increase the delay from 24 to 72 hours. So this is something that we have been seeing, and I think it's part of a broader trend in general to increase abortion restrictions. We have seen over the past few years a real move in the increase in kind of abortion restrictions across the board, and mandatory delays are one of the ways in which they're trying, which abortion opponents are trying to get at making it harder for women to access abortion care.
And do you know what the reasoning is behind this mindset? What is the main thing they go to?
I really think the main point behind the mandatory delays is simply to make it harder for women to access abortion services and to make them feel, to try to shame women when they're trying to access abortion. It's a way of making it harder, increasing the burden. It makes, in most places, women have to do two appointments now, and making two appointments. And for many women, that is challenging, getting the appointment scheduled in the right time period, getting time off work. All of those things make it harder, and it's just one way, particularly when you combine it with a host of other abortion restrictions that are in place.
Right. Now, can you tell me a little bit about the many different things that a woman might think about when she's deciding on an abortion?
Go ahead.
I was going to say, for instance, economics and then, you know, timing and whatnot.
So when women have made the decision to have an abortion, there are a lot of things that do kind of come into play in their terms of how they're going to be able to access them and what they have to think about. So a lot of women do report, you know, talk about the financial burdens that just simply coming up with the money to pay for an abortion can pose, as well as, like you said, timing, scheduling, getting time off work, how they're going to ask for that time off of work if there are places where you have to get, where you have to have a long travel and 2 days because you have a mandatory delay. Then you're asking your boss, I need this time off. Well, why? It forces them to have to kind of make and come up with explanations they don't necessarily want to share with their employers, the people they're working with. And so it tells that there's a lot of things that go into kind of making the plan to be able to access abortion care, as well as trying to get your, if you want to have your family with you, how to get, you know, how they can get the time off to come, how to get arranged travel if you live in a place where you're going to have to get to a long distance, getting a car, like all of those things can be real challenges.
Okay. And could you tell me what the legislative precedent is to allow states to put this kind of restriction into law?
So the courts have in Planned Parenthood v. Casey, the Supreme Court did originally uphold a mandatory, a 24-hour mandatory delay. They held that the mandatory delay itself, the 24 hours, was not an undue burden on women's access to care. That is, it wasn't going to unduly keep women from being able to have an abortion. However, what we have seen since then, since the early 90s when Casey was decided, is this increasing number of abortion restrictions. And so when we start to see, looking at the mandatory delays, as I think we're going to start seeing challenges in the future, there's a different question, because the question of whether or not there's an undue burden, is this affecting access to care, has to take into consideration the whole set of abortion restrictions. And so it's not just this one restriction, but how do those restrictions work together to keep women from being able to have an abortion?
Right, and that makes me think about how in many states that have decided not to take the Medicare expansion through the ACA, a lot of women do not have insurance coverage for this type of procedure. And do you think that kind of constitutes an undue burden or an inconsistent or unequal access to medical, you know, interventions?
So federal funding is not allowed to be used to pay for abortions under Medicaid, except in the cases of rape, when the pregnancy is the result of rape, incest, or threatens a woman's life. However, some states do use their own funding to pay for abortion beyond the cases in which federal funding is allowed. And so Medicaid access, so public funding is an important source of public funding at the state level, is an important source of access for women, being able to access abortions. Being able to pay for having coverage of abortion is another, not having coverage of abortion is a real barrier for women when in being able to afford abortion. The cost of abortion can range from around $300 to $400 to $10,000 or more, depending on the timing of the abortion. So it really can be a large range, and even covering up with the $300 or $400 can be a burden for a lot of women. So insurance coverage of abortion is an important way in which women can access abortions. And in addition, you're right in your question, I think, that funding for abortion is very important and inequities in the way women and funding does keep women from being able to access abortion.
Do you know of any organizations currently fighting for abortions to be included in Medicaid coverage or a court case at all that might be pointing to this?
So the courts in the past have held that Medicaid funding for the funding for abortion is not, again, not funding abortion. Funding abortion is not required by the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
However, there are groups of organizations that are working towards and thinking about how we can kind of overturn the restrictions on abortion, on the public funding of abortion.
Do you know if there's any, like, what policy loopholes they're looking at to fight against these restrictions, like, you know, where they're going in the Constitution or in statutes to say, oh, this actually is wrong?
Well, I think the work right now on funding for abortion, you know, happening both at the state and the federal level, but certainly happening at the state level, is really a focus on the policy arguments for why women should be able to access abortion, and as well as fights under state constitutions that I can't really speak to in detail, but certain states have their state constitutions have strong protection for state statutes that make it easier to make these arguments for why there should be public funding for abortion.
Okay. Do you know of which states have the most progressive laws surrounding abortions?
17 states do use state funds to provide all or most medically necessary abortions.
Mm-hmm.
4 states do that, provide those funds voluntarily, and 13 of the states do that pursuant to a court order. And if it was pursuant to a court order, that would be under their state laws.
Okay. So I very much so appreciate your time. And hope you have a wonderful day.
All right, great. Thanks.
Me too. To paint a picture for you, dear listeners, imagine 22-year-old Sally Fairchild gets pregnant. She was on the pill and the condom broke, and dear Sally already has 2 kids and wants to go back to school to get her master's. This third child will greatly reduce her ability to feed and house herself and others. She has no family, and her friends have their own kids and multiple jobs. What should Sally do? She's a waitress at Denny's, and now she has to ask her boss for 2 days off within a week. The boss wants to know why and tells her no. And if she takes the time, she'll be fired. What should poor Sally do? Both visits require money to pay the doctor, and then there's the cost of the abortion itself, which is somewhere between $350 to $450. Sally has $600 in the bank. Rent is due in 2 weeks.
What's more, there are restrictions on the amount of time that Sally has to get her abortion.
So what does she do? Representative Sullivan says this bill is to help women who are being coerced and pushed into having abortions on the spot, but the data says otherwise. Here is Kelly Blanchard, president of IVIS Reproductive Health, who in collaboration with the Guttmacher Institute published a study on the state of women's reproductive health. Kelly Blanchard from IVIS Reproductive Health today, president of IVIS Reproductive Health. How are you doing, Kelly?
I'm doing great. Thanks for talking with me.
Thanks for being here. I'd like to start, if you could give me a little background on IVIS, how you all started and kind of what your mission is.
Great. Well, IVIS's mission is to improve women's reproductive autonomy, choices, and health worldwide. We are primarily a research organization. We do both clinical and social science research, and we are primarily focused on 3 reproductive health topics, access to abortion, high-quality abortion care, access to the full range of contraceptive methods, and finally, links between HIV prevention, treatment, and care, and comprehensive sexual reproductive health services.
Mm-hmm.
We've been around for about 12 years, and about half of our work is focused in the U.S. and about half outside the U.S. internationally.
we're speaking about new waiting periods that are going into effect across the country before a woman can get an abortion. And I was wondering if you could comment on that and tell us about the study that your organization funded in regards to that.
Great. So we are extremely interested at IDES in understanding the impact of abortion restrictions in the United States and trying to understand how they implicate women. Our first priority is understanding kind of women's perspectives of those policies and how they impact their lives. So as part of our work, we have conducted some reviews of existing data looking at different types of restrictions. And one of those reviews focused on waiting periods and mandatory counseling. So we lumped those two things together just because they're often lumped together in the laws, and so it's hard to study them separately. And this was a collaboration with the Guttmacher Institute. And basically, just to kind of boil it down to the main three things that we found, first of all, these waiting periods have absolutely no medical basis, where there's no data showing that they do anything to improve women's health or that they are a part of quality care. And so that's kind of a piece of background. So when we got through all the data that existed, here are the three key points. So first, the waiting periods, especially waiting periods that require more than one visit, force women, in some cases, encourage more women to go out of state for their abortion. And part of the reason for that is that the cost of the abortion goes up, obviously, when you have to make two visits to the clinic. And so, yeah, so those waiting periods, especially with those visit requirements, increase the cost. And it's not only the cost of, you know, just a visit with a provider, but also the cost of transportation, of childcare, of lost work time. And so particularly for women who live further away from clinics or in states with not many clinics, those costs can really be significant. So those costs lead to women going out of state, trying to seek a service perhaps at an adjoining state where there might not be a waiting period. They also, in some cases, push women to have abortions later in their pregnancy because they have to raise additional funds or, you know, organize a two-day process. And finally, those waiting periods have a particularly big impact on younger people with fewer resources, that more younger people are forced to go out of state to access the care they need or push later in pregnancy.
Right. And are there any legal implications for kind of the burden that would put on a woman? Like, is there any kind of policy that we could look to say, you know, this really isn't right, this is unfair burden, it's an unequal access, or anything like that you could point to or that you know of?
Right. Well, certainly I would go back to the point that there is no clinical evidence that these waiting periods improve women's health or make the procedure safer. And oftentimes they're introduced or publicized as being to improve women's health. Right. And that's not the case. There's no evidence to suggest that that's the case. And in fact, in some recent work we did with the Center for Reproductive Rights, we actually showed that states with more abortion restrictions are actually likely to be states with poorer health outcomes for women and children. Mm-hmm. And we think that's because those same states with many restrictions also have not passed policies that really have been proven to improve women's reproductive mm-hmm. health. But going specifically back to the waiting periods piece in your question, I am not a lawyer, but certainly as you said, the question of undue burden is one where a number of efforts have been made to try and argue against abortion restrictions and to show, because of the Supreme Court standard of undue burden, the question is, you know, how does one define what undue burden is? And I think that question remains with the cases going through the courts about a number of restrictions. I think we don't know. For example, the Fifth Circuit said that a restriction that would have closed the last clinic in Mississippi, that was an undue burden. But then in a different case where women might have to travel equally as far, they've said that that would be a case in Texas. They would say that the Fifth Circuit said that law could continue. So I think there's it's not clear what the standard is for the distance you have to travel or the amount of money you have to pay. And unfortunately, a lot of what we see in terms of impact on women, which is serious and causes many issues for women in terms of having to comply with these laws. It's not clear how those translate in the courts. So our particular work on waiting periods was a review of the existing data. So we did not conduct a specific study on waiting periods ourselves, but we looked back at all of the data that had been published up to 2009 on the impact of those laws.
Your study, has it been used in legislatures nationally to, you know, by people who've been fighting these waiting periods? Are they discussing it? Is it making an impact at all, would you say?
It's a great question. The data is certainly part of the record in many of these court cases. It's hard to say what exactly has an impact, you know, because obviously these cases are filled with lots of different data and testimony, both around kind of the medical realities as well as the impact on women, as well as what we know, you know, about the broader impact of these laws. And so this particular review on waiting periods and mandatory counseling, I can't, unfortunately, cite a specific place where I know this has been important, but I think what is really useful is helping to build up a body of data that really refutes this idea that these waiting periods are good for a woman's health, because mm-hmm. what the studies all show is that they actually have a really negative impact on women being able to access the care they need in a timely way. And of course, that combined with the fact that there's no proven medical benefit of these waiting periods suggests that, and what we know is often the actual goal of legislators putting these forward, that the goal is to reduce access to abortion. It's actually not to improve women's health.
Right. Now, some reading that I've been doing on kind of the pro waiting period side, they say that many women are coerced into abortions, that they're quickly rushed. And I wonder if you can comment on that, that, you know, as you said yourself, these laws are put into effect with, you know, the saying that the reasoning that we're protecting women's health, but, you know, your study doesn't point to that. But do you know where they get the idea that women are being coerced into abortions, or is that just a complete fallacy?
I'm not aware of any data that suggests that women being coerced into having abortion is, you know, a growing problem, and I'm also not aware of any data that these waiting periods actually address that.
Mm-hmm.
We know, for example, when women comes to a provider for abortion care, providers are required by medical ethics, by standards of care, to get informed consent for any medical procedure, ensuring that the woman knows what the risks and benefits are, what to expect, all of those things. And healthcare providers offering abortion care do exactly the same. And the counselors in those clinics work very hard to ensure that a woman is making a free and informed choice. But that counseling can happen on the same day as the procedure. There's no documented benefit of making women wait days in between. And in fact, there's no indication that women then change their mind or have a different outcome based on those waiting periods. So it doesn't suggest that this mm-hmm. is identifying women who are being coerced and helping them make a different decision.
Okay. And can we go back to the study again? When you were speaking of the data that you use to, you know, kind of find the trends and come to your conclusions, like you said that you had interviews and kind of, was it census data that you all used, or how did you collect the data that you used?
Some of the data was published studies from the Guttmacher Institute. So there are a few, the Guttmacher Institute and their partners. And so some of that data, for instance, looked at the impact of waiting periods in Mississippi, using different comparison groups to estimate, you know, what impact they had on abortion access, comparing them to states that didn't have the same waiting periods around them, and also looking at the change in access to abortion care within the state and outside the state, both before and after the waiting period was put in place. Other data come from, there was a study in the literature that where providers were interviewed. There was a very small piece of data where women were interviewed, but the majority were these studies conducted by Guttmacher or other researchers that looked at existing data, either state-based data, mostly state-based data, looking at differences either within a state before and after a waiting period or comparing states that do and do not have waiting periods.
Okay. And I'm curious, do you all do any lobbying in D.C. For, you know, reproductive issues?
We don't. We ourselves are largely a research organization, mm-hmm. and research and advocacy, the advocacy that we do usually takes the shape of ensuring that people have access to the results of our research. Mm-hmm. So whether that's through publications or briefs or social media, so we do that kind of outreach with our work. We do try and work very closely with colleagues in D.C. and in all of the various states. So where we have data that might be useful for education on a specific topic that might be coming up in front of the state legislature or at the federal level, we try and make sure our advocate colleagues have that data at hand so they can use it as part of their work with policymakers so that they have the full information about what the evidence says.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Great. Okay. And one of the other people I spoke to about this is a professor of women's studies and kind of sexual reproductive history. And she made the connection that these waiting periods grossly affected women in impoverished communities more than others. Mm-hmm. And I wonder your comments on that and you know, how that plays out in your research and your advocacy.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would absolutely support that idea. And so, first of all, from this data that we looked at specifically on waiting periods, it's clear that because of the additional cost of the transport of the whatever, child care, lost work time, that having to make those two visits is going to have a larger impact on someone who has fewer resources than someone who has more resources. And not only based on income, but also in terms of flexibility to get time off, you know, ability to, you know, negotiate with one's employer about things like that. So certainly those types of laws would have the biggest impact and be the biggest barrier for women who are struggling to make ends meet. I will also say from other research that we've conducted a lot of our own research on the impact of the Hyde Amendment and other funding bans on abortion access. And in those cases, that restriction is obviously targeted specifically at women who get their insurance coverage through Medicaid, so
right.
People who specifically have lower incomes. And in that case, the women that we've talked to, you know, speak very compellingly about how they have to make very difficult decisions about supporting their family, caring for their children, paying their bills because of needing to try and find the money to pay for the abortion care that they need. Mm-hmm. And so I would say in that case, too, obviously, the impact of restrictions is more acutely felt on people struggling to make ends meet. And I think that's true of all abortion restrictions.
Okay. So what do you think the next step is to kind of, you know, the data, obviously the studies say these waiting periods, they're bad for women, they're bad policies, they're not medically necessary. What's the next step? I mean, 27 states are going this way. Most state houses are largely conservative. What's the next step? For women who, like you, who know better, who have seen the studies?
I think it's an excellent question. First of all, I think that many people don't know about these restrictions.
Right.
And for many people, they find out about them just at the time when they discover that
that they have already been passed.
Right, that they've already been passed, and they discover them only when they need to seek abortion care.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think there's a lot of work to be done just to kind of educate people broadly in our country about the fact that these restrictions exist, and again about the fact that that they are not supported by the literature and that they do have these really negative impact on particularly lower income or younger people seeking abortion care. I also think obviously this issue is tied to a broader question about women and women's autonomy and women's mm-hmm. decision making. And I've been really pleased to see some coverage in the media about the idea that, you know, it's really paternalistic and treats women as less than full citizens with decision making power if they are forced to wait these, you know, whether it's 1 day or 2 days or 3 days after they have made a decision about how they want to proceed with their health care. And I hope that we can have more of an explicit discussion about that as well, because I think it's an indication of how we still have so far to go in terms of supporting women in their autonomy and decision-making and as full participants in our culture, in our society, and in our democracy.
Thank you so much for your perspective and your expertise.
Great. Thank you so much.
Next, we will speak with Jessica Milley from the Institute for Women's Policy Research. We're going to examine why access to abortions are important for women's well-being and the economic future of our country. Jessica Milley, Senior Research Associate at the Institute for Women's Policy Research. Thank you for being with us today, Jessica.
You're very welcome.
This podcast is concentrating on women's reproductive rights and access to medical abortions. And I was wondering if you could comment on what your research has to say about that in particular.
Well, we know a couple of things. One, abortion was legalized in the U.S. in 1973 with the Roe v. Wade decision.
Right.
But recently there has been a lot of legislation that has been proposed in order to either limit women's access to abortion services or completely prohibit them entirely. But what we know from the research is that access to things like abortion services or contraceptives have positive impacts on women's overall economic well-being. They enable women to properly time their childbearing in a way that makes more sense for them. And because of that, you know, they're better able to invest in education, for example, young women being able to access contraceptives and, you know, abortion services enables them to go to school, stay in school, and ultimately that has huge impacts on their earnings later on in life and their overall career outcomes.
So it wouldn't be too much to say that access to family planning directly affects the economy in the U.S.?
Absolutely. There's all kinds of research that shows that when women have access to these types of services, they're better able to obtain higher levels of education. They're more likely to participate in the labor force, which has a huge impact on the economy. And then they earn more over their lives, which helps them in retirement.
Okay, so do you all know of any programs that might be increasing or decreasing that access? I know we're concentrating on mandatory requirements for waiting times before receiving an abortion, but do you know of any that programs through, let's say, Obamacare that might be increasing women's access to family planning and whatnot?
Sure. Well, the ACA increased access to contraceptive and family planning services particularly. And one of the big things that we've seen in just the few years that it has been enacted
is that there's been a huge spike in the number of women who are able to obtain access to contraceptives, for example, at no out-of-pocket cost, which is a huge thing for low-income women. I believe the statistic is somewhere around 10 to 15% of all women prior to the ACA were able to get contraceptives at no cost. And after the ACA was implemented, that was bumped up to about 67%.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a huge impact.
And I understand that some states allow abortions to be covered through the ACA and some do not. Does that
right.
have any repercussions federally as far as, equal access?
Sure. So I think the part of the ACA that you might be referring to is the ACA facilitating states' ability to expand Medicaid family planning services,
right.
particularly surrounding coverage for abortions. And so that, again, definitely has implications. While abortion is legal in the U.S. still, many women in different states that have provisions like waiting periods or living in states that have not expanded Medicaid to cover abortions, they face unequal access and they're not able to have the benefits of, greater reproductive rights that women in other states do.
Are there any suits going to court to challenge this equal access federally, or do you know of any?
I don't know of any off the top of my head. The big one that really sticks out in my mind, which I'm sure everyone has heard of, was the Hobby Lobby case that occurred earlier last year. But I don't know of any that are currently going on.
Okay. For our listeners, can you just give us a brief synopsis of the Hobby Lobby case?
Sure. The basic idea is that the ACA requires health insurance companies to provide contraceptive coverage for all workers who are part of these plans. But there are certain exceptions, such as religious institutions. Certain religions oppose the use of contraceptives. And so Hobby Lobby, for example, is a nonprofit organization, or it's an organization that has closely held religious beliefs. Their owners have a religious affiliation. And so they went to the courts and said, look, we don't agree with this particular provision. We don't want to cover contraceptives for our employees because it goes against our beliefs. And so that went to the courts and it was ultimately upheld.
Right. And can you tell me, back to the research that you do personally, can you give me a synopsis of women's health in the U.S. As compared to maybe other countries and sort of access to reproductive care?
We don't do so much of an international comparison with other countries. But in terms of access to reproductive health, there have been a couple of trends that have been going on since I think 2004 was the last time that we looked at this issue. There are a couple of improvements that have taken place in the last 10 years. More and more states are requiring insurance companies to provide coverage for infertility treatments. So 12 states now require that compared with just 9 in 2004. So that's a slight bump up.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of abortion access, between 2004 and now, the percentage of women living in counties with at least one abortion provider declined in 22 states, but it also increased in 24 states. So kind of we're in the positive in terms of changes taking place in that regard. But there have also been some places where we've actually gone backwards. And so that's kind of what you've been focusing on, is increases in legal limitations to women's access to, say, abortion services. I mean, in the first quarter of 2015 alone, state legislators introduced a total of 332 provisions to restrict access to abortion services. And by April of this year, 9 had already been enacted. So there's a lot of legislation that's being considered now that are trying to limit women's access to abortions in particular.
And can you speak on the main reasoning behind these new legislative pushes? As far as, you know, are they trying to limit are they trying to increase the waiting limits because it's safer, or is it really kind of just like a another push or a battleground for the pro-lifer? What would you say?
I'm not sure if I could tell you exactly what the rationale is behind such provisions, but I would imagine that a lot of it has to do with trying to put as many barriers to getting an abortion as you possibly can without making it completely illegal. So the more restrictions that you have, say, making a woman wait for 24 hours, you know, you're more likely to get more women to choose not to have those abortions than if they were able to get them immediately.
And is there any correlating data? I know you had said that, you know, in some states there's progress being made, and then others, you know, we're kind of going backwards. Is there any correlation between those numbers and other data that you look at? I'm trying to think. I only ask because I read this article from a pro-life institute saying that suicide rates are higher in states with looser abortion laws and whatnot. And I kind of, you know, I wonder from someone, you know, in policy research, if you actually see any correlation, not just, you know, suicide, which, you know, could be just like one of those things, but amongst other things as well, education or, you know.
Yeah, that's a really good question. We don't particularly look at correlations across these different indicators. We have a lot of data, so it quickly becomes a beast to tangle with.
Yeah. New algorithms and whatnot.
Yes. And I haven't really seen any of this research that you've pointed out, but one of the big things that we always learn in statistics when we first take that introductory course is that correlation does not equal causation.
Mm-hmm.
There could be a correlation between suicide rates and higher abortion rates, for example, but we don't know if that's because the higher abortion rates or higher access to abortion is causing
the higher or the sampling size of the
right exactly.
Okay.
But what I can say is that based on far more rigorous research that tries to control for all of those things that could be affecting the relationship, there has largely been evidence that shows that access to contraceptives and access to abortion, you know, reduces, you know, teen pregnancy rates, which helps to increase college enrollment and college completion, which has tangible and large impacts on women later on in their lives.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Well, I thank you so much for taking the time out of your day to speak with us. So there are many things to think about here, and thank you again to our guest tonight who illuminated why a seemingly harmless restriction could disempower thousands of women. If you want to know what you can do to oppose this law from being signed into existence, call Governor Rick Scott at 850-488-7146 and tell him that waiting periods and abortion restrictions interfere with women's autonomy and reproductive rights. Tell him to keep politics out of women's medical decisions. And with that, I thank our listeners for joining us on the Progressive News Network tonight. Once again, this is your guest host, human citizen Christine Sylvain. And to send you off this evening, here is Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, sampled
in Beyoncé's song Flawless. Thank you all, and good night.
We teach girls to shrink themselves, to make themselves smaller. We say to girls, you can have ambition, but not too much. You should aim to be successful, but not too successful. Otherwise, you will threaten the man. Because I am female, I'm expected to aspire to marriage. I'm expected to make my life choices, always keeping in mind that marriage is the most important. A marriage can be a source of joy and love and mutual support. But why do we teach girls to aspire to marriage and we don't teach boys the same? We raise girls to see each other as competitors, not for jobs or for accomplishments, which I think can be a good thing, but for the attention of men. We teach girls that they cannot be sexual beings in the way that boys are. Feminist, a person who believes in the social, political, and economic equality of the sexes.